This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, Clinton's proposed environmental budget has a lot more money for open space and livable communities. But environmentalists are still angry about appropriations to help the coal industry and finance timber sales from national forests. Casinos in Mississippi are bringing in the green, but the Gulf Coast is not getting any greener as a result. We ride the waves with surfers who have organized to protect the ecosystems upon which their sport depends. And in the Earth calendar, Punxsutawney Phil has come and gone. His handlers say when it comes to predicting whether spring will come, he has never gone wrong. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The president has just submitted a proposed federal budget, which, if enacted, will do more for the environment than any budget he has previously submitted. How much of it will pass will be determined in skirmishes with congressional committees, which will continue until September. This year, the environmental stakes are high.
Well, in a tight money year, I think the president's proposed FY 2000 budget is very strong on the environment, overall up 5% from last year. And the budget proposes a number of major new initiatives, including a land legacy initiative, which would create a permanent stream of funding at $1 billion a year for federal land acquisition, for transfer in part to states and local governments for green space and parks, and also for coastal states. So that's the first time an administration has ever proposed full funding of the so-called Land and Water Conservation Fund created in the mid-1970s.
That was George Frampton, acting chair of the Council of Environmental Quality in Washington, speaking from his office in the White House. He adds, there are increases across the board, 5% for the Environmental Protection Agency, 8% for the Park Service, and 9-10% for land management agencies. The money will come from operating revenues, since budget surpluses have been reserved for Social Security. The president's budget proposal is designed to impact the places we live.
Well, there's also a major initiative to make communities more livable that includes, among other things, a very significant transfer of Transportation Department money to public transport. We've proposed a new $100 million a West Coast Salmon Restoration Fund that would be create a partnership between the federal government and the states of California, Washington, and Oregon, and Alaska, and tribes to try to restore coastal salmon runs, and some major new provisions to deal with climate change, including additional tax credits for fuel-efficient equipment and automobiles, and a new EPA fund that would help businesses invest in new technology that both cleaned up the air and reduced greenhouse gas emissions at the same time.
Frampton says under the initiative, localities in conjunction with the Environmental Protection Agency will be able to finance open space, brownfield development, and clean water projects through Better America bonds. The person who buys the bond would get the federal tax credits in lieu of interest. Despite the increases in funding, some environmental organizations disapprove of portions of the budget plan. Anna Aurelio is a staff scientist with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.
U.S. PIRG says that this budget is a mixed bag when it comes to the environment. When it comes to protecting public health and the planet, we applaud several of his land acquisition initiatives and other climate change initiatives, but we're extremely disappointed that President Clinton continues to support subsidies to multi-billion-dollar polluting corporations. Well, for example, our national forests are under attack by corporate loggers. We have been urging the Clinton administration to cut subsidies for logging on our national forests. The General Accounting Office just came out with a report that showed that taxpayers lost $1 billion over 3 years in below-cost timber sales, and yet the president's budget continues to fully fund the timber sale program.
Aurelio is also upset about requests which will benefit the coal and oil industries.
They're asking for $122 million for coal research and development. They're asking for $50 million for petroleum research and development. And then finally, there is the oxymoronic clean coal technology program that's been really a laughing stock for a long time. This is a program that's supposed to give money to companies to help them burn coal cleaner, although, of course, they're never going to figure out a way to burn coal without releasing carbon dioxide, which is the chief culprit in global warming. And it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, to figure out a way to burn coal without releasing mercury, which is a potent neurotoxin and has caused, you know, 50,000 water bodies in this country to be declared, the fish from those water bodies are declared unfit for human consumption. So we're not going to be able to solve those problems regarding coal. And so the real answer is we're going to have to shift away from coal. And yet this clean coal technology program continues to eat up our tax dollars if we continue to fund it.
In contrast, Daniel Leshoff, senior scientist at the National Resources Defense Council, a national environmental group, applauds programs in the budget which forward the campaign to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Perhaps the biggest piece is a $3.6 billion tax incentive package that's aimed at commercializing advanced technology vehicles that can get substantial increases in fuel economy and therefore reduced global warming pollution without sacrificing size or convenience. It also includes a tax credit of $2,000 for energy-efficient new homes and some expansion of tax credits for renewable electricity production.
On balance, with the exception of coal, gas, and timber programs, environmentalists find a lot of the president's proposals to be enthusiastic about, as reflected by Courtney Cuff, legislative director of Friends of the Earth.
Well, overall, we're very pleased with the administration's budget. It's a good budget for the environment, spanning from the Better America bonds to the livability agenda that includes the land's legacy proposal, and also including things like the $730 million sort of a package, if you will, to help deal with climate change. It's extremely positive for the environment.
How much of the president's environmental budget gets enacted remains to be seen. However, since many of the new funding initiatives involve partnerships with state and local governments, the administration hopes it will generate local political support, which will translate into votes on the floor of the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. Southern Mississippi is in the midst of an economic boom, due mainly to a rapid increase in the number of casinos along the Gulf Coast. While the gaming industry started out small in the earlier part of this decade, the casinos in Mississippi are becoming bigger than ever. But as with many prosperous industries, there are environmental trade-offs. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports.
Originally, gaming boats had to sail out to international waters before passengers could place bets. Then, in the early 1990s, the Mississippi legislature voted to allow casinos to operate along the shoreline. Voters in two of the three counties along the state's Gulf Coast also approved gaming. Dockside barges were brought in first, but with time, the casinos and hotels grew in size as well as cost. So far, 11 casinos have been built right on the coast, with at least a dozen more casinos and hotels with permits pending. Some of these are huge buildings with parking garages costing hundreds of millions of dollars. Steve Oyvanki, director of coastal ecology at the Department of Marine Resources in Mississippi, says many of these coastal areas were once run-down, turn-of-the-century seafood processing plants.
It was pretty much a run-down, blighted brownfield-type area. All that has been raised now, and now it's a glitzy Las Vegas-style strip. It looks a whole lot better than it did before, with run-down, dilapidated shacks and buildings.
As with any development project, environmental impact studies have to be conducted, and it's the state's job to protect water quality and issue certain permits. The EPA, National Marine Fisheries Service, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife also comment on the process. And the Army Corps of Engineers provides permits for structures and when wetland areas are filled in. Ronald Crisman, chief of the Corps' regulator office for the district that includes southern Mississippi, says so far 11 acres of wetlands have been filled in and says his office tries to make sure the adverse effects from filling wetlands are minimized. He says other factors are also considered during the permitting process.
We look at the visual aesthetics aspect. We look at the cultural aspects. Are there any archaeological assets there that would be impacted by this construction? Endangered species. So we look at pretty much the gamut of environmental issues.
However, the casino boom along Mississippi's Gulf Coast happened so quickly and on such a large scale that state and federal regulators admit they were caught off guard by some of the environmental problems that have surfaced. Among them is pollution, especially from Highway 90, the major artery that brings gamblers to the coast. Hotels line one side of the highway and a seawall lines the other, which means there is no room to widen the road. Steve Oyvanki says as cars build up on the roadway, so does the pollution.
Because right now the runoff is not treated. I'm talking about non-point source, you know, automobile drippings, that sort of thing, grit, cigarette butts. It goes directly through drain pipes into Mississippi Sound. As more and more traffic piles up, cars sit at lights, it causes more and more of a problem from a non-point source standpoint. But you get the same thing anytime you have traffic anywhere on a coastal road like that.
In addition, the lure of good-paying jobs is attracting out-of-state residents to southern Mississippi. As a result, Steve Oyvanki says housing and waste treatment are issues state and community leaders are being forced to address.
Those people have to build houses because there's a housing shortage. And all the sewered areas where they could build houses are already taken. So they're going to go out in the counties and put in septic tanks in houses where they probably will not work. That's the major non-point source pollution problem facing us. Is where to put these people, how to get the sewage systems out to the people to prevent the pollution of the waters.
Also, runoff from septic tanks has already polluted some oyster beds located along coastal areas. However, the recent construction of two waste treatment plants is helping to deal with the problem, and more facilities are planned. Oyvanki says the Department of Marine Resources has instituted a resource management effort to deal with the environmental effects of gambling.
Biggest thing ever happened to Mississippi. But we didn't plan for it. We planned small, and it came in big, and we were caught by surprise. So our commission asked us to develop a comprehensive plan to look at the long-term future effects of this. And we've got all of the state, local, federal regulatory agencies, all the cities and counties, all the environmental groups, concerned citizens, all sitting down talking about the problems, how we can best manage it, and what we need to do in the future so we don't caught by surprise again.
Before gambling came to Mississippi's Gulf Coast, the state was running a deficit, unemployment was high, and many of the coastal areas were deserted industrial sites. Oyvanki says the goal now is a delicate balancing act, trying to maintain the economic engine while protecting the environment at the same time. He says planners are trying to steer development away from sensitive areas with wetlands and marshes and towards places that can handle the pace of development, something that was not done previously. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. We'd like to hear from you. Call us at the Environment Show. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org.
And this is Ear to the Ground with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, riding on a new wave in environmentalism. Surfers make up a very unique youth-infused subculture. The culture has its own music, beginning in the 60s with groups like Dick Dale and the Deltones and the Beach Boys. It has its own clothing styles like surfer baggies and bikinis, as well as its own movie genre. Beach blanket bingo, anyone? But what people may not realize is that surfers have their own environmental group as well. It's called the Surfrider Foundation. According to the organization's executive director, Pierce Flynn, Surfriders was created in 1984 at the Surfrider Beach in California.
It began in a fight to defend one of the world's best surfing waves at Malibu, which was famed from the Gidget days on through, from being destroyed from water pollution and also a groin development on the point that would have altered the sand flow. Thus it started, people protecting the things they loved most, surfing areas and surfing waves.
A user group, much like Ducks Unlimited, who worked to conserve their playground, Surfriders, now based in San Clemente, California, is comprised of about 25,000 members in the United States. Most, but not all, are surfers. Other members include swimmers, coastal dwellers, beachcombers, and a host of celebrities such as Jewel, Jeff Bridges, Tom Hanks, and of course, the Beach Boys. The group also has 40 chapters in four other countries where surfing is big: Australia, France, Japan, and Brazil. Flynn, who's been surfing since the fifth grade, says Surfriders is providing CPR to surfing areas and the ecosystems that surround them.
So that we're talking about preserving, again, the rarity of these breaking waves. They're not destroyed by ill-planned human projects like harbors or groins and jetties. Surfrider also has a part of its mission to preserve the biodiversity in the beach area. Everything from the dolphins that play, that also surf the waves, to the bird life in the whole watershed, as well as the water quality. Because much of our national coastal waters are in danger of pollution. That is a health hazard to not only surfers, but to all who swim in the ocean.
If you put together all the excellent surfing areas in the world, Flynn says, it would probably span only 7 miles. Those sites include the Banzai Pipeline in Hawaii and Kura Beach in Australia.
What makes them perfect is their perfection, their natural power and vibrancy, and the way that they'll break along a point, usually, the length of the perfect wave. Of course, there's lots of waves that can be ridden, but the perfect ones are absolute wonders of nature.
One-of-a-kind wonders of nature like Old Faithful or Niagara Falls. Flynn explains that surf is the area of breaking waves. He says as ocean swells are blown across the ocean from wind or storms generated in places like New Zealand or Alaska, they move rapidly towards coastlines around the world.
As they do, they form swells. And as they come in contact with the shallowing water, whether it's a coral reef like in Hawaii at the Banzai Pipeline, or a continental shelf in California or the Outer Banks, the way the swells will heave and they'll pitch and they'll throw out and create surf, or create waves. And those waves can be ridden, and that's the magic.
surfers play in a small portion of what Flynn describes as a coastal watershed. This watershed includes coastal mountains where melting snow runs all the way down to the beach. It's a vibrant environment, he says, made up of wildlife that includes deer, dolphins, crabs, seals, whales, a variety of birds, and humans. The animals come for food, the people for recreation. Flynn says in California alone, about 95% of the coastal wetlands have been destroyed, lost to pollution, development, and boating. The optimistic surf riders work to restore the natural system through beach cleanups, educational programs, and the legal system. Ann Pierce Flynn says they've just started a new chapter called Snow Rider, aimed at snowboarders and skiers, designed to increase environmental awareness among those who ride frozen water. The Surfriders Foundation is proving that there can be more to surfing than just riding the waves. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. We can expect an early spring. That's the message from Punxsutawney Phil, the climate forecasting groundhog that comes out of his hole every February 2nd to make his annual prediction. Phil did not see a shadow this year, which means we can expect less than 6 weeks of winter. The groundhog doesn't exactly say when winter will end, and it's only the 13th time in 113 years of making predictions that Phil said spring will arrive early. What's even more interesting is that Phil has never been wrong, according to Mike Johnston. He's a member of the inner circle of the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club.
We find that those people who question the science have perhaps missed the point.
Johnston says this is because Groundhog's Day is rooted in European folklore.
It was brought to this country in the late 1800s, predominantly by German settlers. They settled in this area. Candlemas Day was a holiday that was celebrated, and Candlemas Day is the middle day of winter. It's 6 weeks after the beginning of winter and 6 weeks till the end. We use the term commonly cabin fever. Cabin fever had some significant meaning to those folks who were living in cabins in 1870 and were 4 miles away from their closest neighbor and had 3 feet of snow piled up against their door. It was perhaps a convenient reason to get together with your neighbors and share a good time to break up the boredom.
With tongue firmly in cheek, Mike Johnston says Phil is very old.
We don't know how old he was when we inherited him, but we've had him for 113 years. Now, normal groundhogs that don't have the royal bloodlines that Phil has, live on average of 7 or 8 years. That's a normal lifespan for a groundhog, at least in this part of the country. Phil, being 113, certainly is the exception to that.
Johnston attributes Phil's longevity to the small amount of groundhog nog he receives once a year from members of the Groundhog Club. It extends his life another 7 years. Mike says he tried it once, but it only made his hair turn gray. He also says members of the Groundhog Club are often asked why they wear top hats and tuxedos on that special day that Phil makes his predictions.
Because of Phil's standing in the animal world. I mean, again, he's not just a groundhog. He's true royalty. Those 15 of us who are called upon to support him and protect him. We even have some members who are trained to take a bullet for him if need be. But our formal attire is only in keeping with his position within the animal world.
When he isn't making long-range forecasts, Phil resides comfortably in a federally inspected habitat at the town's municipal building with his wife Phyllis and cousin Barney. Phil apparently made no mention as to whether global warming will contribute to a shorter winter season this year. I guess we'll just have to wait till next year. And if Phil emerges from his hole wearing sunglasses, Bermuda shorts, and suntan oil, you'll know things are surely changing in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a craftsman hand makes canoes entirely out of wood. The historic dugout has evolved into a piece of art. We talk green about ski resorts and national forests. Developers want to build more trails and lifts, but others say the resorts are too big already and we don't need any more. A green tip on a humanitarian urge that should be resisted. And we go hiking through passes in the Colorado Rockies with author T.A. Barron. Mountain views and fields of wildflowers uplift our souls. Stay with us. Picture yourself in a canoe. You're drifting quietly along a slow, winding river. It's a lazy summer day, and the noise of modern life seems a million miles away. For many of us, it's a great way to spend an afternoon. And native Caribbeans agreed. The word canoe is taken from the language of Carib Indians, who dug out trees that were strong enough to be used as boats. In the 1600s, Native Americans began making the traditional style of canoe that we're familiar with today. European settlers copied their ideas, and it was the French who established the first canoe factory in Quebec in the late 1700s. Today, many man-made materials like plastic are used in place of wood. But in the Berkshire Mountains of eastern New York, there is a carpenter who is helping to keep the traditional form of canoe building alive. Stephen Westcott takes us there.
Well, here you can take a look at some differences in boats. Here's, you might look at it and think it's a kayak, but actually it's a one-man slalom canoe. Low volume versus, this would be like a slalom race boat, and this is like a marathon race boat. Totally different design.
That's Greg Sowers describing some of the boats he has at Old Timers Pleasure Craft, based in Canaan, New York, near the Massachusetts border. Greg is a retailer of paddles, life jackets, fiberglass kayaks, and virtually everything else you need to get started. Besides the unique spelling of Old Timers, that's OLDETYMERS, what makes this business really special is the cedar-stripped canoes that are handcrafted here.
You start off selecting the boat you want to build. So, you know, if you can get a set of plans, that's the best thing, and you get the a table of offsets, and that's all the numbers on there that you would set up to get your forms made from. So what you call, that's called lofting, actually. So you loft all your numbers on paper and draw your lines out, and then you'll get your station shapes, and then you'll just transfer them on wood and cut them out.
A station is a piece of wood cut in the shape of a hemisphere. They are mounted on wooden horses and set about a foot apart to form a mold. Cedar wood strips that are about an inch wide by a quarter inch thick and as long as needed are placed over the mold and glued. Sometimes the planks are heated, which helps Greg bend them into place.
Glue them to each other and staple them onto the forms. And once a groove sets up, they pretty much lock themselves into each other, and they stay that shape. And then you just continue on, strip after strip, until it's complete.
Once the planks are in place and the glue is dry, the form of the canoe is established. But a lot more work lies ahead, mainly in the form of hand sanding.
On the outside, I'll spend 10, 12 hours fairing it out, and on the inside, I'll spend that much, again, sanding. You do an awful lot of sanding, a lot of cedar dust in the air.
When sanding is complete, a fiberglass coating is applied to the entire canoe.
It's a clear glass skin that you won't see, and use epoxy resin on that. And for today's kind of boating, it keeps a wooden boat practically maintenance free. And the strength that skin adds to it makes it a lot stronger than the traditionally built boats, which is a big plus.
It takes Greg about 6 to 8 weeks to build a canoe. The finished product is a beautiful cedar vessel. The clear coating really makes it shine as it rides across the water. They're so attractive that Greg says passers-by often buy them on the spot, which makes it difficult to build up an inventory. He started building fiberglass canoes about 20 years ago, but for the past 6 years he has been building only wooden canoes by hand. It's been Greg's dream to build boats full-time, and with the renovation of his barn complete, he now has a workshop to make his dream come true. One of the most unique features about Greg's business is that he custom designs a canoe to fit a customer's specifications.
I'll take their ideas and work it out and make a boat that they want. And everybody wants something different out of a boat, and with a wooden boat you can change it somewhat. You know, you take a boat, you know, a fiberglass boat in a mold, how it comes out is how it's going to be. No changes. But with the wooden ones, you can change a few forms and stretch it out a little bit. Make it wider if you want.
An old-timer's canoe sells for $100 a foot, with the larger guide boat selling between $3,500 and $5,000. It may seem pricey to some folks, but these boats will literally last a lifetime. More importantly, perhaps, is that Greg is carrying on a historical form of woodworking and traditional form of transportation.
With the name of my shop, old-timers, some people come to me and they think I'm the old-timer. And I say to them, I says, I'm not the old-timer, it's that the boats are, the design of the boats. I'm taking a lot of designs that were used back in the late 1800s and bringing them back. And again, I'm taking some of the old boats that a lot of people we'll just trash out, throw them out, or burn them and restore them. You know, there's the old guides back in the old days, they knew how to get around and they knew how to design boats.
Whether it be whitewater rapids or calm flat water, Greg enjoys all forms of canoeing and kayaking. What makes it even more special for him is the sense of pride he gets when riding in a canoe that takes him to those special places the natural world offers. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. It is ski season, and while many ski areas around the country had a mediocre Christmas season, most of us who are skiers think the best is yet to come, when the days get warmer and the sun is brighter and we have more light. It turns out that about a quarter of the nation's 525 downhill ski areas operate on land that's owned by the U.S. Forest Service. That means you and me as taxpayers. And the Forest Service then leases the land to companies that build and operate the resorts. But despite flat market demand, multi-million dollar expansions are now being planned at many areas whose names you've probably heard, like Vail and Keystone in Colorado. There are environmental groups who are opposing much of this ski development on public lands, and in some cases they're going to court in an effort to stop it. So we're going to look at this issue. Should the Forest Service be leasing more land to ski area operators? And I have two guests who know a lot about this subject and probably don't agree on anything. One is Scott Silver. He is executive director of a group called Wild Wilderness, It's an environmental group based in Bend, Oregon, and he is also a member of the Ski Area Citizens Coalition, which is a recently formed group focusing on environmental and social impact of resorts. He joins us from Oregon. And also with me is Geraldine Hughes. She's director of public policy with the National Ski Areas Association. She's in Colorado, and her trade organization represents ski resorts and others that are related to the ski industry. Welcome to you both. And Scott Silver, let's start with you. Most people think of skiing as a pretty healthy family sport. It's certainly more benign when you think about public lands than logging and mining. So why shouldn't ski areas be permitted to expand?
Well, because, amongst other things, there's no need for it. You said that the demand has been flat. In fact, over the last 10 years, there's been a declining demand, which really doesn't justify taking more land and converting it to the particular use of a ski area.
And even though the areas may be able to do this successfully and people enjoy it, your sense is that enough is enough?
Well, no. Simply, there isn't need. That land has other values. To convert land into a ski area generally means disrupting habitat for the animals that live there. It means cutting the trees that live there, the trees that exist there. And it means taking public lands and turning it to a dedicated use, the dedicated use being downhill skiing. I would just contend there are other competitive uses, and unless there's a need for ski area expansion, there's no reason to go ahead with it.
Geraldine Hughes, obviously, you're...
If I could jump in?
Absolutely. Where do you come out on that issue? What I hear Scott saying is you don't need it.
Just a couple of things. First, I think it's really important to put things in perspective. Today, public land ski resorts occupy less than 0.1% of national forest lands. On that small area, they accommodate 30 million skier visits a year. Second, I disagree with the characterization that we're looking at declining demand or collapsed market demands. I think that the ski industry is a very future-looking industry, and we're trying to plan for it and not ignore the demographic trends that we see coming towards us. First of all, we've got the Echo Boom generation, which is 78 million strong and will provide unbelievable demand for outdoor recreation. We've got the aging but very active and wealthy baby boom generation that's placing a huge emphasis on quality of life. And people generally are seeking quality of life as a priority in their increasingly hectic lives. So,
well, Geraldine, let me ask you something about one of the criticisms about the industry and recent press reports, and I'm sure you've seen them. There are those that say, hey, the ski industry really isn't selling downhill skiing. That's incidental. What they're really doing is selling condos and home sites, and they're in the real estate business, which is what is spurring the business of expansion, so people can have condos that they can ski right up to from the resort. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, first of all, I think it's wrong to give the impression that hotel or real estate development is going on the public lands, for starters, because that is taking place on private land that is adjacent to or next to the ski areas. And resorts are just meeting the demands of the public in providing better facilities and all of the amenities that the public is demanding from resorts.
And Scott Silver, the argument is there is the demand out there. It's a legitimate use. Probably more people ski than do other things, so why not?
Because the demand is going down. Locally at my own ski area here in Bend, Oregon, ski numbers are down from 650,000 10 years ago down to 580,000, and the trend is downward. I'd like to respond to what Geraldine said, however, about the fact that skiers only occupy a small amount of land. Yes, it's 190,000 acres, but I contend that just like an acorn is but a small thing, it will grow into a very, very large tree. In much the same way as all-terrain vehicles spread noxious weed seeds as they travel around and cut paths through the forest, changing the forest, so do ski areas lead to urban development, commercial development, and sprawl. Ski areas occupy a small area, but they impact an enormous area, far, far larger than the small area they're spoken of. And the other point is, even though the commercial developments, the condos, are being built on private land, often that private land was public land that was recently traded in land swaps of very, very questionable value to the public.
Scott, I think that's a gross generalization, but I also just want to ask Scott the question, wouldn't you rather see the impacts of the public recreating on the forest taking place at a managed recreation site like a ski area rather than uncontrolled and all over the place? Because ski areas, in fact, manage the impacts in an environmentally sensitive manner. I mean, isn't that a better alternative than having a free-for-all on the public land?
No, because Geraldine, people are not going to be doing downhill skiing except at ski areas. And the people who use areas that are ones that ski areas would like to expand into have a perfectly good right to use that land. A very hotly contested area is the Telluride ski area expansion right now, where backcountry skiers, people who ski without the aids of lifts, are saying that the only remaining decent backcountry area is going to be co-opted for downhill development, and literally not for downhill development, but for resort development.
I'd like to get into this issue of the resort development question, though, because it is argued that the tremendous expansion, which is argued where the money is, has huge land use impacts. Geraldine, to what degree is selling condos and home sites critical to the successful financing and financially successful operation of a ski area? The people who say, hey, they're not making money skiing anymore, what they're doing is making money selling houses, and that's what the game is. Is that a fair criticism?
No, I think you're probably basing that on a small number of the larger destination resorts. As you said at the start of this show, there are 500 ski areas out there, and I guarantee you that for many of them, they are very, you know, small mom-and-pop operations that provide skiing as the main attraction. You know, there are the larger destination resorts that provide lodging and other amenities as well at ski areas. But I would just like to emphasize, too, that it's real easy to point to the resort as the sole growth driver or culprit for growth in a resort community. And I think that that is no longer the case. I think that people are moving to mountain communities in large numbers for reasons that have nothing to do with skiing and snowboarding.
All right. Well, let's go back to skiing for a moment. Scott, I gather your sense is that enough is enough, and we really don't need to devote any more public land to this. I'd be interested in whether Geraldine thinks there are places in which public land should not be turned over to proposed ski areas. And if there are, how do you decide which ones they are?
I would just like to say, for starters, when we talk about turning over an area to a ski area, you know, public land area to a ski area, the areas to which ski areas are expanding have already been designated by the Forest Service as suitable for resort development, sometimes decades or even 20 years in advance of the actual expansion. And I think that's a very important clarification that I would like to make on the basis of something that Scott had said earlier. These are lands, you know, they're not wilderness areas. They're areas that have been identified as having the best and most suitable use for ski area development.
Geraldine, may I respond to that?
Sure.
Sure.
In Oregon, there is a proposed development for Pelican Butte Ski Area. It's the first new ski area that's been proposed in many, many years. The environmental community is saying there could not be a worse area selected if one specifically tried to. It is designated bald eagle habitat. It is designated late successional reserve, which means old growth forest. To create the ski area would destroy habitat next to a wildlife refuge. It is the worst possible area, but it happens a large real estate company has built a resort at the base and now would like to improve the value of that land by creating the ski area. There is no other reason for that. And in Oregon, the ski numbers, as I mentioned before, are down dramatically. To create another ski area so close to Mount Bachelor is simply to cannibalize the existing skier base and to move it somewhere else. And there's no other reason for that than real estate speculation.
Scott, what I heard Geraldine saying is that there is a planning process, and admittedly, perhaps a lot of these areas were designated before we had the sensitivity that we now have for endangered species and the like. Does the planning process, if it works properly, ensure that lands that should be protected are protected? Is there a process that works, or is the whole system?
Absolutely. There's a forest planning process that the public is very intimately involved.
Okay, great. Scott, what's your sense on that?
The process doesn't work whatsoever. In fact, for the Pelican Butte area, the person on the Forest Service Committee who was responsible for making the decision also happens to be the president of the Chamber of Commerce of Klamath Falls, the local town. The level of bias to promote ski area development within the Forest Service overrules all scientific judgment. Basically, the Forest Service is looking to ski areas as revenue generation, and each individual area sees their ability to get some sort of revenue from their local ski area development, and the process is being exceedingly perverted for financial gain. Both
Geraldine, your reaction to that?
I think the process is being perverted by abuse of, for example, the National Environmental Policy Act process. Environmental groups are continuously using statutes like NEPA or the Endangered Species Act to get to your end result, which is, just absolutely no expansion of ski areas whatsoever under any circumstances. I mean, we have a process and we have laws, and the ski areas are doing very well complying with those laws.
But Geraldine, at Pelican Butte, the parking lot for 2,000 cars would be directly in identified bald eagle habitat that's been protected already in a wilderness study area.
I'm sure that all proper mitigation will be done by the ski area and required by the Forest Service if there is that type of habitat located within, the area of the ski area.
Okay, well, I'm afraid our time is up. We've been talking about ski areas on federal lands. Should they be expanded? My guests have been Geraldine Hughes from the National Ski Areas Association and Scott Silver from the environmental group Wild Wilderness. We'd like to know what you think about this issue. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can tell us all sorts of things about yourself and what we could do better on the Environment Show by responding to our questionnaire at our website. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. When I was Environmental Conservation Commissioner in my state, I learned midwinter is when people call with questions about feeding deer. The human instinct to supply food for wild creatures perceived to need nourishment seems almost universal. With respect to feeding deer, it is also almost universally a bad idea. Microbes in the stomach of a deer digest its food. And the microbes that digest the woody browse and your favorite backyard shrubs the deer have been eating all winter cannot cope with the hay, corn, or peanut butter sandwiches you may wish to offer. Stuffing the wild creature with food it can't digest may do more harm than letting it go hungry. But wait, you say. Don't bother me. I don't feed deer. But the lesson is still important. Terrible results have frequently occurred from well-intentioned human intervention in natural systems, like filling in wetlands or killing wolves. When we think we're doing good, we usually don't have the humility to ask whether we were doing the right thing. But we need to try. because saving natural systems may be more important than trying to fix them. That's our green tip for this week. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author T.A. Barron, it's the Colorado Rockies, where a mountain ridge makes you feel like you can face anything. In this portrait of place, Barron reads from his book titled, To Walk in the Wilderness, A Colorado Rocky Mountain Journal.
For the first 3 weeks of our month on the trail, we saw almost none of Colorado's renowned blue sky. Instead, we saw great quantities of rain, fog, rising mist, falling hail, and sideways blowing sleet. Then, at last, the clouds lifted, the sky brightened, as did our moods. Here is my journal of day 25 from Tewaukin Wilderness. From our perch on top of the pass, it is easy to follow the rising sun's advance over land and sky. Rosy beams strike the clouds, transforming them, while the mountains follow, one radiant step behind. The luminous procession continues, moving over one ridge, then the next, one summit, then another, until, at last, the entire world, as far as we can see, is bathed in a new morning light. The breeze blows crisply, tousling our sleeping bags. It is dawn. Passing through a long alleyway of bluebells, we drop over East Avalanche Pass. Stark towers of stone etched against the rich blue sky line the ridge. Westward, we can see dozens of drainages, contorted and wild. Snow clings to the shadowed cirques, while red paintbrush, blue lupine, and yellow cinquefoil make the meadow under our feet ripple with vibrant colors. This is a day to go on forever. As we stride along the ridge, we hear the continuous rising and falling of wind in the passes, streams in the valleys, birds in the cloudless sky, and shifting rocks in the ravines, all combining in a single sonorous fugue. As the ridge stretches before me, so it seems does life. Full of hope and opportunity and challenge, today I feel ready to face anything. Even as the late afternoon light deepens the hues and shadows, signaling the inevitable approach of night, I feel far more joy at having lived this day than grief at having lost it. By a tarn surrounded with marsh marigolds, we make camp. Sunset comes slowly and intensely, reflected on the craggy spires of Meadow Mountain and the neighboring peaks. When I wake before dawn, my sleeping bag is coated with frost, as if the stars have descended during the night and lodged there, sparkling for a while.
That was T.A. Barron, reading from the book he co-authored, To Walk in Wilderness, A Colorado Rocky Mountain Journal. It's published by Westcliff Publishers, Incorporated. Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. To learn how Punxsutawney Phil will gamble the federal environmental budget away on a Mississippi riverboat, order a copy of the program. Call 1-800-323-9262, order show number 476. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Turner Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for the Environment Show.